when we had to go with von Braun in that Gestapo prison there in Stettin, then and I came out a week later than von Braun.
How many
I had to do a little bit more defense than he did.
How many of you were taken there? You?
Riedel?
Grutter?
Hüter, I think.
Hüter also?
Hüter not?
Oh, I didn't know that. I know Grutter.
Hüter was later my boss when Riedel was killed.
Braun and Riedel.
Now, Riedel, Braun too, von Braun, my mother, Miss Schumacher at that time, my wife, myself, but that's not all, there must be two more. And of course we were then put up very nicely because they opened up their offices, you know, we were locked.
Could you explain how did it all start? Were you all taken at the same time? Where were you when they came in? What were you doing? What were the circumstances?
I think von Braun was taken a night or two before. So I had already a little warning that something would happen. Of course, I did not know what was behind it. Von Braun, you know probably the story how that happened. It was, he came late at night home, around 12 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
maybe 11, maybe 1 o'clock, in that little place in Kosovo, which was rented by Mrs. Spohn and Dr. Spohn.
Mm-hmm.
And just when he entered the house, the Gestapo people came out the bushes. You know, the house was mm-hmm. surrounded by bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And said, okay, please come with us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I had heard of that. Then I was in that house when they drove in front of that house. This was the old farmhouse.
And that is where?
Inselhof.
Inselhof. Oh,
yeah.
Inselhof.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And I looked out of that window
mm-hmm.
when I saw them driving in. My brother, who was a young fellow, he was a, you know, the 17, one of these worker soldiers with
mm-hmm.
his base.
Mm-hmm.
Automatically he became soldier with 18.
Mm-hmm.
Automatically he became an officer in Russia. He went down to what is the last position there in Russia?
The Polish end, you mean?
Where they turned around there.
Oh, the Stalingrad.
He was all down to Stalingrad.
Mm-hmm.
And he was back, later, all the way back and defended a gasoline factory around Stettin.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there when the Russian rolled over the Inselhof because he was wounded for the seventh time. Now that's the story on the side.
I'd like to get that later. But
you want that?
Oh, very definitely. But let's complete your first story. Then we'll talk
about
that's very good.
Yeah. Now, my brother had just come on leave. I think it was his sixth leave from Russia
mm-hmm.
when the Gestapo rolled in with two cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking for a moment, should I run through the fields in the back? It would be very easy.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't have me. But I had the feeling von Braun was already taken,
mm-hmm.
and it would take some more of my family,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to leave them alone, so I say, okay, I go.
So what happened? They came in the door?
I crossed and say, hello, what's the matter? I say, what are you looking for? They ask me very seriously, who are you? I say, this is okay. So they say, get prepared, we leave here in 10 minutes with you. So we got my wife, my mother, all in the car. I was prepared. I had always two files on my hands. The Inselhof had with the Nazi party always difficult from the beginning. And in the Nazi time they say they were communists, and later they say they were, yet now, my brother was 3 months after the war was over, taken by the Russians to Russia. We never heard a word from him. And that was done by the people in town, who again said, now, they were Nazis from Braun lived there.
Right.
And before, there was Trude Hesseberg, which is a famous lady from the theater and cabaret here, and she was Jewish. She never was Jewish, so we had Jewish people.
Jewish.
Yeah. And of course, I had one half Jewish, that's that one. He was a man on a theater, that's me, by the way, on the end.
Oh, yeah.
There is a... I have better pictures, this is just a preliminary.
Mm-hmm.
He was from a theater in Aachen. I studied in Aachen once.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got trouble with the party there. I got him here, and he was a pianist, you know, where these people are dancing there. And so they found out in Aachen at the university that his grandmother was Jewish. And I had the biggest trouble
by the president of the university, who was a former friend by us.
Mm-hmm.
He called me by first name, but he had to do it, you know. They were forced by the Nazis to do something. And I had the biggest trouble that I had that man here on the envelope as piano player.
Mm.
Now, so we were moved to Stettin. I was prepared and I had my files with me.
Mm-hmm.
And these files I had collected already for another occasion before. My mother was already shortly put in prison because she fed cats with milk. And you should know my mother. You had Mrs. Schlitzel from Braun. She all know her. She's quite a lady.
Mm.
She tells the Gestapo people, I tell you, I have corn here. That means grain.
Mm-hmm.
And when I have grain, I have rats and mice. And to keep them down, I need cats. Mm. And when I have young cats, they need milk to get strong cats. Or otherwise, you don't get any grain from me. In short, the story.
Yeah.
But don't she have to go in prison for a few days in Swinemünde, where I visited her?
Uh-huh.
I remember.
What did they charge you? Just for the milk?
Yes.
And what did they say to you?
They were picking on the envelope.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
They were picking on the envelope in any way they could.
Anyway.
When we had East workers there, and they went to Swinemünde, there was this lady who also did the beginning of the whole, that we all came to the Gestapo prison. There was one lady involved, a female doctor in Sinowitz.
Mm-hmm.
She always froze them sick. So the workers came back and said, "We are sick, look here," and they were real smiling.
Mm-hmm.
And the grain was there and didn't come down. I had to vent myself out with the machine to bring that down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was another thing. The party didn't want to give the concession to give alcohol out on that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a turning point. At this time, I was fighting the party at court in Swinemünde. It is a Verwaltungskort, that is the administration court,
mm-hmm.
to fight this through. And at that time, I learned that they had already collected many files. And I say, "Let me show the files." They say, "No, you cannot show them, but they are terrible, and you cannot get that concession." And finally, I won that case against the party, and that was a bad thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Then my wife had done a trip to Holland with von Braun. You know, there was one of the friends von Braun had, I don't know his name right now. And she was with him, so she was a spy. So that's why she had to go to.
And she was a spy, and she went with him. What did she do during the war, your wife? She was what?
Helping here on the envelope with my mother. She was secretary. My mother. She was selling, she was helping in the restaurant, everything what she did in Boston.
Uh-huh.
Now, and I had a bad record because they found out, and that they found right away out the first day at the Gestapo, there were 23 possibilities to be in a party, in stronger ones or in little ones. And I was in none. That was enough in 44 to be, you know, these kind of fellows they didn't like. So, but with these two files, I fought my case. There was a Mr. Müller who had to talk to me every morning, and finally he gave me the typewriter, and I typed, "Here's Hannes Nielsen has to say the following," so I typed it in, and that was accepted. And then the boss there, von Braun will remember him, he was a very nice fellow, I must say, an elderly man, and he had the order from Keitel and Himmler to put us up. You know, Keitel and Himmler were sitting at breakfast in Führerhauptquartier. That's what I heard later, not knowing what to do with this group now.
Mm-hmm.
They had heard, I have to tell that too, there was a barber in Sinowitz who opened up a construction company. You could do that in Peenemünde. He bought two trucks, he got 50 East workers,
mm-hmm.
and said, "I have a company now." So he asked for jobs in Peenemünde and got them. But in the Schwabes Hotel, he was drunk one night. And he was thrown out down the big stairs at Schwabes Hotel and had to leave the party. And he wanted to come back in the party. And he, as I found out later, is the man who invented this story that von Braun wanted to leave with the map for the V2 to England. And the plane was always ready. That was true.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother was a flyer. And that was true.
Mm-hmm.
But he never intended to fly to England.
That's how it all started. At a barber.
Yeah.
It was trying
this barber started that terrible story. And that was connected with the stories which were collected at this female doctor, where Mr. Gertrude did a little loud talking. He He was a good friend, I think, of that lady. Von Braun and Magnus, I think, were invited there too sometimes. And there was some talking, and the story is that they say, oh, we really want to go to the moon, and this is only on the side what we are doing here, something like that. And that was enough at that time.
Right.
Now, this I was not there. I don't know in detail. But
so what, did he ever have any leanings towards the east? Did he ever say anything favorable about it?
Yes, I will tell that. Gruffel will remember me because when we, I jump now, when we were in the Harz Mountains, Gruffel was living on a bigger farm. And Dr. Axter and myself were sent out to pick him and his wife up and make that famous move from Witzenhausen, from Bleicherode to Witzenhausen.
Yeah.
Everybody was there and Gottschalk was not there, so we had to go up to pick him up and go with us over there. But soon we were in Bleicherode. He left again and moved back to Witzenhausen, to the Russians.
No, back to Bleicherode.
To Bleicherode,
yeah.
To the Russians.
Right, yeah.
So that last trip I made,
did you have any idea why he did this?
He said,
I know what he said,
that he hoped to open a company there in the East, you know, and work for everybody. That's what he said.
Yeah.
What he is thinking, you have to ask himself.
Yeah. Okay.
And I would not even know.
Yeah.
I only know that when we had to move, he did not move with us.
Mm-hmm.
And while nobody was forced, he was the only one who was really invited to come now, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting back up to the Gestapo. Now, you and others, were you all kept separately and interrogated separately?
Even at meals. I saw my mother sometimes in a big restaurant that she was with the Gestapo men in the very back, and he waved, but he could never talk to
him. Did you see Brown and Riedel and they?
No, just...
Just long distance, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what happened then, finally? How did you get out? What
the first one who showed up was Dornberg, and you know what he did.
Okay.
You read in the books that he went to Hauptquartier and told him, you never get to see them, you don't get Von Braun.
Mm-hmm.
And on his word, Von Braun was temporarily left out of this. Temporarily, I wouldn't say, but they were not ready to let him go.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, Keitel and Himmler were sitting at breakfast and say, how do we tell the Führer? Oh, I wanted to tell about that nice gentleman, you know, that elderly gentleman in the Gestapo there.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I say, okay, but you don't believe it, what I tell you. I have to jump again. I have to say how I got, I know the file. There was, my father was killed in the World War. And there was one high Nazi organization who had to protect these people who, you know, the family of where the fathers were killed. Kriegsopfer Versorgung was the English. And this was a high ranking political lady. And my mother knew her and told her the story about the interval. And she said, oh, I can get the file. And in Berlin, where I was, she said, next Thursday, please visit me. I'm not there, but the files are on my desk. And I looked in the files, and my wife was on the phone in Berlin, in our apartment. And the important things, I dictated it down on a telephone. And now we had them. We could say, what you say is not right. That's stated later, but white was made to black. Really the story is this. And really the story about the Indians is this. And about the Jewish people is this. And it's this. And it's this. So when I came to the Gestapo, I told all this. This has a letter with the date of that day, with the Aktenzeichen number so and so. And it says the following. And the next letter says exactly the contrary, which is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
He said, hell, I will have to go and look it up. If that's the truth, then we have to let you go home. I say, hell, I wouldn't. I know where I am. I have to get Gestapo. I wouldn't tell us, then it's not the truth. So he went up to Swinemünde, looked over the files, and came back really broken.
Mm.
He said, hell, what are we doing? I think the whole thing is nonsense.
Mm.
They were helped a little bit by the hotels, too. There were two hotels in Sinowitz, which thought the little Insel was a competition to them, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Because we're always full and they had to fight to have people for afternoon coffee.
Uh-huh.
So he said, boy, I think that is a local affair there and it's all a lie. And so he reported to Keitel and Himmler again. And they had headaches again and they went into the Führer and said, Gestapo recommends to let the people free. But the Führer said, hell, go slow. That's what I was told. Please go slow because... first, it's a big story, now it's nothing, I can hardly believe it. But then Dornberger pushed, mm-hmm. and Dornberger got from Brown. I understand temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
He had to watch that he didn't escape or anything else. But a week later, I looked out the window up there, and I discovered who was there in his tatra from Brown. And he waved.
Mm-hmm.
So he got us out.
Okay, he got all of you out.
Yeah. So we went home.
And that was the end of it?
No. Not for me.
Not for you.
I came back to Peenemünde to work, and I was real mad. I say, for no reason. I was no underground, I was no nothing. I was, of course, not a member of the party or any of the organization, but that's all.
Mm.
I have not done anything wrong. And I want to fight. I was a fighter at that time. I want my rights here.
Mm.
And Tansen said, boy, I have the same trouble. You know, I have the same as you. He said, forget about it.
Mm.
And then suddenly, the next day in Kölpin, Tansen called me and say, are you there? I say, you hear it. Please stay in the office. I come right away out to see you and talk to you. So he came out, put me out of the office, and halfway between street and office, we walked, the people said, what are they doing? And he talked to me, more than an hour, and he said, you have to leave today for France. I say, you are joking. That's impossible. My laundry is not done. Oh, you get somebody, you bring to your laundry. I said, why should I leave? I cannot tell you. General Dornberger, ordered by General Dornberger, you have to leave today. Now, after he talked an hour, finally, I start believing it.
Yeah.
And I say, but you know the situation on the Insel are only ladies, my wife and my mother, and East workers. And they are already now so upset there, and I don't know what happened when I'm leaving. I'm the only one who keeps them a little bit together.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, you have to go. So I went back and told Riedel, and Klaus Riedel was already shaking.
Mm-hmm.
He said, oh, I go with you on the way to Berlin, we go to Schwedt, you know what Schwedt is.
Very good.
And in Schwedt we asked what the reason is. He thought the whole thing started again. So at Schwedt we arrived at night, it was dark, and Oberstleutnant Thom, with whom I did all my military work,
mm-hmm.
not Peenemünde so much was my, but Thom was our man for Riedel and me.
Oh, okay.
He was sitting, in sleeves and little lamb, I still see. Listen, I think you are in Paris. I say, on the way, Oberstleutnant, on the way, but first you have to tell me what's going on. Okay, when you promise to leave for Paris tonight, I will tell you. So he told me that General Dornberger had seen an order to put me in concentration camp. There was an order out, and that was shown to him by the famous Abwehr officer with a little beard. Von Braun knows his name exactly, I have a little bit forgotten. He was later hung because the story goes, he was on both sides. It's now for Bormann that he was on both sides. You read that in a newspaper?
Mm-hmm.
Bormann?
Yeah.
So this man was with the Russians as well as with the German Abwehr,
mm-hmm.
military Abwehr. I'm not sure that it's true, but that's
mm-hmm.
what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
This man was a knight and showed Dornberger that here, listen. And Dornberger acted immediately. And I said, Oberstleutnant, why? I have never done it. Yeah, because we know that you have never done it. We know you very exactly and what you are and what you have not been. This is why Dornberger decided to send you to the military people in Paris. You stay there and don't come back until we tell you. So I in boots and riding breeches, but civilian clothes between the military. And who? There I had to report to my neighbor on the Insulum, that was Axter. You heard about
Axter.
So he was in charge of our group in Paris.
What was the group called?
Verbindungsstab zum Oberkommando West or so ähnlich. That is the liaison staff for Dornberger
mm-hmm.
to the high command, German command, which was outside of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
I was several times with Axter there to
mm-hmm.
to discuss, so you can ask Axter.
Yeah.
Have you seen Axter?
Oh, okay, he's done it.
Now,
could you go back a minute and just describe briefly the setup that Dornberger had in Schwedt there. What was that like when you went there and Thom?
Yeah, Dornberger was in Peenemünde until this military organization was set up, located in Schwedt.
What was that like? Just describe
I think handled the Heidelager too.
That's right.
That was part of it.
Right.
It was just a military organization with many troops which had no place in Peenemünde. They had to find another place.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the title? I'm so terrible in titles.
Yeah, well, I can check that out.
Yeah,
sure.
From Brown knows.
Yeah.
in any book.
Yeah,
not
right.
only in this
yeah,
one, you
yeah,
find
sure,
what
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to.
And he was, of course, the commander there. He left Petermann at
yeah.
Samson,
yeah.
and he was in charge there. And Samson had to report in a way to Dahlberg.
Dahlberg of that in straight. Now, of course, when Samson went out and ran
until the SS General Kammler, and I was there again. I tell you that.
Where were you that time?
Now I was in Paris,
right.
and what was my job? I had to investigate places for Regenbogen.
Ah, I see.
He said, okay, between Paris and Belgium,
mm-hmm.
I got a lieutenant and a German jeep, and we both, he was my driver, and we both drove through the whole countryside, checked on maps first to
mm-hmm.
find places where Regenbogen could be constructed.
Mm-hmm.
We instructed troops partly who had to do the construction, but I think much wasn't done anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, it was by now it was 44. It was not 45 yet. I think when we were through, when I came back from Paris, it was 45. I was there over Christmas. I was there, I think, 9 months. And I was always, you know, I was a little, not homesick, but I want to see what's going on in the Inselhof. So once I prepared a big show that the command from Peenemünde had to drive with all the military vehicles through an artificial Regenwurm. You know, the wooden construction in Puderglas was built there, and with all of these vehicles they had to drive through and make a training.
Yeah, I actually got pictures of that.
Yeah.
That was a training, those pictures then, showing them driving through this wooden structure.
Yeah,
training for Regenwurm.
Yeah, where did you see the pictures?
I got the pictures in my collection in Huntsville.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I arranged that.
I
and
see.
For
and
that,
where were they made? What town?
That was in Puderglas, I think. That
Puderglas.
Was
okay.
where Steinhoff was located, close to Steinhoff's yeah. location.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know, I drove out with my driver and he drove me there, and I don't know exact. Oh, you ever met him? I did that show there, so I had a reason to go on a duty trip to Peenemünde again.
From Paris, to show them how this Regenwurm operation would work.
At that time it smelled already, and I know I would probably not return to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So I packed my suitcase, put it in the middle of my room, and told Axter, in case you have to move out of Paris, please take my baggage,
mm-hmm.
which they did.
Mm-hmm.
When I returned after 6 days or something like that, I came only to Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
But in Brussels I had not the right connection, so I moved back to Aachen, just over the German border.
Mm-hmm.
And there I could go upstairs and called our group in Berlin, you know, I know their
mm-hmm.
military phone number, and they told me where our boys were. Our boys, mittlerweile, in the meantime, had Dornberger and Axter and all, they had left and were south of Düren. Düren is next to Aachen, just over the border. Here's Aachen, here's Düren,
yeah.
and here's somewhere on it. In a watershed post. There we were located.
Mm-hmm.
And here is where Dornberger wanted to start the launching here in these woods, you know.
Yeah, I see.
At this place. And so I ride away from Aachen down there and met all my friends there again. But now happens this, that Kammler got the job.
Well, that time when Kammler came out.
Right here.
Yeah.
Dornberger was told to sit by still, but he was sitting around, didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Kammler was in charge. Next day, von Braun and Steinhoff arrived from Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm.
On the sandwich, they had already, I saw they were Inselhof sandwich, my wife had made.
Mm-hmm.
God, what sandwich from home. And they wanted to visit Braun, and Braun said, come with us.
So they wanted to visit Kammler.
Kammler.
Yeah.
So we went to Kammler's house.
Where was Kammler's house at that time?
A little, just that night he was sleeping.
But where? Was that near Durin?
Yeah, south of Durin. Axter will know exactly
okay.
that chateau where we were.
Uh-huh.
And there was a very little house, and there were only Steinhoff, von Braun, and myself visiting Kammler, we three.
Mm-hmm.
And we came first in the morning at a decent time, I think 10 or 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock. And there was a guide in front, a guard, and said, the general is sleeping. Come back in the afternoon. What time? Oh, by 2-3 o'clock. So we returned in the afternoon and then could speak to Kammler. And the discussion with Kammler was very short. Mainly he said, okay, I don't need you. I think I know everything what has to be done here. And when I need you, I will call you.
Mm-hmm.
And you go back to Peenemünde and see that things are going right up there. So von Braun and Steinhoff had to leave again. And I asked him, could you please take me with you? What should I do here any longer? And I returned with him to the Inselhof. So there I was, without permission, but there was almost nobody anymore who could give permission. It was all, you know, mixed up already. Now then I was there a week or 10 days, and we had to leave to the Harz Mountain. And in Harz Mountain I was again the planning man for von Braun, because there came not only Peenemünde on ships, on horse cars, on railroads, even the cow on the railroad, Steiner had for the babies, I remember that.
The cow on the railroad?
Yeah, with two trains from Pudagla, you know, from Steiner's place. Yeah, he had a cow on the railroad for the baby.
So that's really, well, before we get further, you move down to the Harz area, Blaschenhausen, so Nordhaus.
Yeah.
Let's get back to this situation on the west when the Kammler took over. Now, do you remember any of the people? You know, the folks have been a General Metz, General Heinemann, a Colonel Vachel.
Is that not the Air Force man?
Yeah, he was supposed to be.
He's supposed to be one.
No, yeah, right, but that was all under Kammler.
Vachel. Yeah, yeah, that probably came all under Kammler. I don't know.
It all did.
My visit was only the Steiner von Braun. Twice in the house of this man, and then I left.
What was your impression of this man, one, and two, does anybody have a photograph of him?
Yes, I have seen the photograph. I think it's not in this book, though.
I haven't seen it. I don't recall it from that book.
It's not in this book. He was very beautiful. He was had a scarf and nicely dressed, and and he came, I think, from a construction job, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And people who are in charge of construction are mostly pretty pushy.
Yeah.
Is that still... So, I would say he was, to me, a smart fellow. Good-looking fellow, too. Mm-hmm. I have seen a picture of him. Now I don't know in what book.
Well, I don't...
Come up a moment, should I help you?
Well, then...
Now...
Did you meet any of the staff around Kammler that were in charge of the operation?
He had no staff around. There were just this...
Well, he had troops that launched the...
He was very on his own. He had one guard in front that was maybe his driver, too. He was very... a wild general.
Were you ever associated with him?
And he slept at daytime, you know, because he probably had driven... all night, or I don't know what.
But he moved around a lot.
Yeah.
But did you ever get in touch with the operational launching groups of the V-2?
No, only with Dornberger.
Did he?
Dornberger had a launching group there, too, but he had to leave them.
Then so, he left them in charge of Kammler.
Yeah, I have seen them ever so often, many people in our liaison office in Paris.
Right.
But I don't know who is who.
Yeah.
I know especially Svoboda, who was my liaison man because he was a construction man.
Yeah. Did you? But you never were on a site when they actually launched them against England.
No.
No.
Okay. And when I was, investigating there in North France for the Reagan one, I did not know what the V1 was looking like.
Mm-hmm.
It was that secret in Finland. Yeah. You know. In Peenemünde, we were close together, but I had never seen a V1.
Mm-hmm.
And we were real surprised seeing these low birds flying there in France,
mm-hmm.
looking out at night. And then next day we looked better, and then we saw the land in the fields. But before, I had not known how a V1 looked.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so I went back to the Inselhof, and then I had to go with von Braun to the Harz Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
I still had a car, and I got a driver from Peenemünde, and we turned our car and went down to the Harz Mountain. I left my mother and Miss Schumacher, my later wife, still at the in-laws there. And down in the Harz Mountain, I had to see that all these people who arrived there had located. Not only Peenemünde, but the University of Dresden, and all these. They arrived. And we had telephone scripts through the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, you take this highway here and you start, take every school, every barn which is empty you can find and locate, and tell me how far you have gone, and then report that back to me, because then I send the next group who can continue on the road.
So you set people up and work in all the groups around the place, or
that type of
area. Right.
And one night I was just in Heinrode, which was the Hüter's headquarters,
mm-hmm.
and Hilton was in Heinrode. That is a little outside of
Bleicherode.
Mm-hmm. One of the towns.
Right.
We were not only in Bleicherode.
Yeah, right.
I myself was in Bleicherode, please. And then there was our Peenemünde telephone girl, and she was connecting all the time. And so I said, Bob, is so busy here? And she said, no, not directly. I said, could you not hear what's going on? Yesterday there's help for them, look, you know, big meeting in Van Brown's villa in Blaise Road.
Mm-hmm.
I say, that smells, and I better go.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down there, and what was it? The list of the last 150 important people who had to go to the Alps
mm-hmm.
were selected there, or, you know, were discussed more or less. The list was already ready. I looked at the list, and I was on that list.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to Van Brown and Axter, I say, you know, this time it is a little bit more serious. You go under direct supervision here of the Gestapo with their rifles. And I think you don't want me, because soon they know whom I was. You know, I was earmarked for the concentration camp. They might shoot me, and you don't want to see the blood. So how about getting me from the list? And I was taken down from the list, and it was decided I stay with Ries in Blaise Road.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the railroad station. De Beek, I remember, he was real drunk there. He had to go down, you know, they had to leave the family,
mm-hmm.
down to the Alps, so I didn't make that trip.
Mm-hmm.
And we started already. After the Americans were through, I could tell you how that happened, but that was not too dramatic. That was very quiet. Only in my house, three young lieutenants moved in. Mr. Schumacher was Mittlerweile had arrived with the last automobile by our friend Nimwegen. You heard
Nimwegen.
The name Nimwegen.
Mm-hmm. Nimwegen was what ran the transport and so forth.
He brought blood sausage down.
Mm-hmm.
You know how they got to the blood sausage, the famous story?
No.
The cattle between the Russians and German lines
uh-huh.
were not milked anymore.
Sure.
They were crying there. And
yeah.
so Nimwegen with the one Schlachter, we say, what's this? Animal killer.
Mm-hmm. Butcher,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was out, and at night in trucks, they got this cattle and made sausage from it. And from this blue sausage, we lived for months and months.
Oh,
they feed them in the group.
I see.
So he brought that down and brought Florence Schumacher down.
Mm-hmm.
So she had my trouble, and I got my trouble to see American lieutenants, I remember. For instance, they stole my car.
Where was this now? What town?
Blaise Road. Oh,
that was in Blaise Road itself,
yeah,
Blaise Road. That's where you first ran into the Americans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I was in Blaise Road.
Okay.
And Reeves too.
Yeah, right.
And
were you tied in? Okay, go ahead.
And but we were already talking to the Americans, and there was already a liaison officer, so I complained to him that they had stolen my car and drove them out in the field where I could not get the car out, and he said, okay, I take a stronger car, and we pull that car back.
Mm-hmm.
What he did. That was in the morning when we had just loaded all the Peenemünders, which had no, and I think I was the only one with a car there, more or less. All the others had to go by train
mm-hmm.
and make that famous move to Witzenhausen.
Mm-hmm.
And in that morning, they stole my car.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also went with me, and we pulled it out, and I drove to Witzenhausen too. Now, in Witzenhausen, I had to make one famous trip. Von Braun will remember that. A part of the group was up in Cuxhaven, you know, for showing the British people how to launch V2s.
Right.
And one of the fellows was Palaoro.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they were all back in Witzenhausen, were prepared to go to the United States. But Palaoro said, I will not go because my son is missing. And that story was the following. One night in the Thuringia Mountains was Mrs. Palaoro living with her parents, and two Negro truck drivers were outside at the window, the black fellows, and said they should open there. They couldn't speak much German and should open the door.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very afraid and opened the door and said, Miss Palaoro, you want to see your husband? He's going to the United States. If you want to go with him, prepare your things. We will load them in 2 hours and get your children, and we drive you to him. He's on the other side in America. And now, big crying, she crying, the parents crying, the neighbors came in crying. What a night.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody crying. And finally decided to take care of Doris, which was older, but to leave the little boy who was real, had a cold and was real sick, with the grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Paramore didn't like, his
mm-hmm.
family.
Mm-hmm.
So Von Braun was looking for somebody who was driving back in the Russian zone and got that little Palaoro.
I see.
And that was me.
Oh,
and Miss Schumacher was going with me.
Uh-huh.
And Miss Palaoro in the back of a car. Uh-huh. And we tried directly to Blackerode, and we didn't come through. And we tried a little bit more south, and suddenly we had the Americans on the other side. We were by mistake coming on the control on the other side, and the Americans didn't let us go through because everyone was flying to the west and saying, back, back, back. But I could convince them that I had to go back. I could be happy to be on the Russian side, but there were no connection with the highways. I had to come back over the border.
Okay.
So finally from Coburg, from the very south here, From here I moved over then into the Russian. Yeah, first I went to military headquarters and I said I want a guide and I want gasoline, a guide with a gun, and he said no gasoline and no guide, no nothing. So I went, he helped me to the border, and there was a lieutenant in a little school, and he gave me a Jewish tailor from New York, and he was sitting next to me with his gun, my wife was sitting in the back. And with Miss Paloro, and we crossed the border here high in the mountains, was Paloro's limb. And there they were crying again, he wants to pick up the little boy. Miss Paloro had already given up several times, said, let's go, let's try back. I think we tried 4 days to cross the border. But finally we had him. We, of course, had to do a little lie. We told the lieutenant we had to get an important scientist.
Oh.
And then I brought that important scientist back. I think he was a year old.
Yeah, oh, I see.
Oh, we unloaded him before I reported to that lieutenant in the school. In the school, and say, thank you, we got that important scientist now in Cambridge.
Oh, God, that's fantastic.
And I had only one pass. On that pass said, this man is okay. This is a stamp of military government. That was my pass at that time in Germany. And with this pass, I could get gasoline for my car, you know, which had only American, had only gasoline.
Did you keep that pass?
I don't know. I don't know. I have somewhere a place. I found my diary the other day from spring 1945. That was very important to me because I did not remember the date exactly, but I found my diary back, which I wrote every day what has happened in
Terrific. Oh, that's awesome.
End of the war. So, not from there, you know.
No, right, the story, I guess.
No, then,
good
then
story,
we went
so.
To... And you know our slow beginning in Fort Bliss.
Yeah, that we don't have to... I mean, I may have some...
And
we're going to now talk briefly about
Dr. Stone.
Dr. Bones,
belonged to Killing's group, and he had in Peenemünde a small testing in which I think these injectors were tested. That was his special field.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing he did in Huntsville later. I think he worked on that same field there.
Right.
Now, he of course came to America more or less by mistake. It was not he was not directly asked to come because he was a prisoner of war. He and Dr. Schinkel were together prisoners in South Germany. As that last 150 people were moved to the Alps, also, the military group, the so-called VKN, was moved to the Alps too, and he was one of them. And there was one lady or one man, which I think cleaned that uniform rock in front, on the front porch, when the American moved in. They saw that military uniform, and in that building there were soldiers here, and so they caught Schinkel and this fellow, who was supposed for me to go to the States. He was a construction man with a test group. He was number one on the list. But since he was a prisoner, I moved in from the second list on his place. And Schinkel and Brown and this fellow became all prisoners. Now, we did not know where Spohn was. He was really in Heilbronn later, in tents in prisoner camp. They had no buildings, sitting in the outside for weeks, and he has still these things. He was able to drop little notes that he was shipped with a truck to another place, that he was shipped in that and that direction, and he was there, and they should please submit that to his wife there and there. And these little notes, without much of an address, have arrived.
Yes,
he has three of them.
He still has three of them?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting to know. We'll make a record of that.
Yeah.
Dr. Stone still has three of the notes. You might want to get a photo of that.
Yes, yes.
Very interesting.
My sister just showed it to me.
Oh.
So, finally, he wound up with Schinkel in Belgium in a bergwerk, in a mine. This mine was already vacated for normal work, but now they were opened up again with German prisoners and Belgian criminals. And it was rotten and you breaking down. It was a real sour operation. I think he finally could work himself up in the kitchen peeling potatoes, I think. While Schinkel, I think, was down in the mine very often. But one day, American officer came on a jeep, loaded them and drove them 50 miles on the highway. Then he stopped, set them on the side and said, okay, here's the contract. You want to sign this? You have a contract to go to the United States. They were more than surprised. The war was over. They didn't know where their relatives are. Didn't know what happened to Peenemünde. Didn't know who that contract, where that came from. Yeah. So they talked for about an hour. And finally they decided, they think nothing could be worse than going back in that mine. So we better sign it. So they signed it. And they were brought to Landshut, and you know what Landshut is?
Yeah.
And there my sister and myself met Sponge. And I think he had only 2 weeks and he had to leave for the States.
Well, he went to States, right.
Yeah. And he was really dashed by this prisoner business because I could hardly recognize him. He had learned to make out of metal can drinking cups and cooking on it. And he had no furniture in that thing and he was still a little shady and was even in the first time in Peenemünde in the spring. Now he overcame all that, but this prisoner time was not the best for him.
Yeah.
So he was pulled, and one day, he had to move very quickly to the States. However, they have besides that he is a director of the South German Portland cement concern, a technical director, he also had a private cement factory in South Germany, which was still operated by his father, but his father died in 43, and there was nobody to take care for it. Also, there was no tax arrangement for from his little salary he got in dollars. He had to pay high German taxes here, double tax paying. He couldn't afford that, so he had to return to Germany.
How long did he stay in the States?
He was still there when we moved to Huntsville.
That's right,
he was several months in Huntsville.
And then came back.
Mrs. Bowen has still a newspaper article by this lady who is reporter lady there. Her sister is in City Hall and her brother-in-law is Monroe, I think.
Now,
my brother is also well known because with 17 years he became the owner of the Inselhof. That happened this way. The Inselhof was started in 1932. You know, Hitler came to power in 1933. In 1932, handicraft artists, one of them was my sister, she did hand weaving, looked for a place on the Baltic Sea where they could settle, work, and sell. That was their selling room here in France. And sell. Because in Berlin, you know, you get hungry and there was not much to do. And here, at least in the season, came many people and drinking coffee, and it was a good place to be. So they selected this place here. Then came Hitler in 1933, and he removed the first fellow there. He put him in concentration camp for a little while. He came free, but for 3 months he was locked in and he had to leave this place. And he opened up the Berghof, this is the Inselhof, Islandhof, and the Mountainhof is next to Garmisch-Partenkirchen. With my sister, he opened that in South Germany. So they moved here. Yeah, and who had that place? The most handicraft artist, who had maybe given 2,000 marks or in that thing, took the money out and left. And left was my mother and my brother with lots of debt because they, you know, they took all their money out. Now it was too, had to develop in a too nicely place to give it up. But my mother could not take it over because she, while always working in agriculture, already my grandfather was a big farmer, and she had to go over the fields with it. But she was also, with that political maneuver, you know, was not allowed to take the Inselhof over. But they had nothing against my little brother, who was 70 years old. And since this used to be a farm, it had to be one man who knows farming. And he studied agriculture for a year. So he was made owner. And my mother took over, now was under 20 years, what you say?
The guardianship.
Yeah, under 20 years. So that worked.
So that worked.
But it worked pretty poor. After I had my diploma examined, you know, and my master's degree, you might say. I went here for 2 summers to bring this place in shape here. And that was around 36 there when I was. And there's the beginning again. So, when I arrived there, my brother-in-law had to leave because he came soldier with a spade, I told you that. Mm-hmm. Automatically, spade, that means civilian workers, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but military trained.
Right.
He was in a camp for two villages from there. So he came back on Sunday. Mm-hmm. He could talk over the agricultural problems where I was not the firm. He told me what to do. Mm-hmm. And then he became automatic soldier in Russia, and as I said, 7 times wounded, mm-hmm. Stalingrad and back. Mm-hmm. And on the end, when von Braun had already left and it was not Peenemünde headquarters, it became Navy headquarters.
Peenemünde became Navy headquarters?
No.
Oh,
von Braun's headquarters.
Right.
You know? He was sleeping upstairs in that building.
And after he left, the Navy moved in.
The Navy moved.
That's in April of 45.
In between, we had another interesting little thing. There were Tatars. You know what Tatars is?
Yeah.
In Russia?
Yeah.
They volunteered after they became prisoners
yeah.
to fight on the German side.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, were not put in on the Russian side. They were in South France.
Mm.
And they fought with horse carts
mm-hmm.
on their own way. And when they had leaves, they didn't know where to go.
Mm.
So the Ministry for East Affairs
mm.
put recreation headquarters for Tatars. And Mrs. Schumacher had to go and get military food in Swinemünde from the military people to cook for them.
For the Tatars.
Yeah.
Oh,
with girls from the east, from the Ukraine,
yeah.
which were also very German friendly.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had also Polish people, and they had every Sunday meetings here in this room, and we were later by the party again. That's another reason, I think, why my wife, my mother had to go in prison there. She allowed these Polish people came together on Sundays, you know, and they bake cakes and they drinking, dancing, and
mm-hmm.
had a good time. And
mm-hmm.
that was just not enough. Not enough.
Yeah. Well, tell me now, this was after the main group, let's say, left Peenemünde.
Yeah, Peenemünde went to the Hartmann.
Right, and the Navy took over.
And that was nuts for the Indoor. He did not make any money.
Yeah.
So they from the East. Now, then came this East Ministry.
Yeah.
Sent the Tatars in.
Right.
There was a Tatar prince. He was a very nice fellow. He was an adjutant in the East Ministry. Very nice fellow. He was there all the time, and he checked that the groups were doing all right, and the Tatars did their own cooking. They had
mm-hmm.
cooks and everything brought them in.
Mm-hmm.
And were nice and very friendly fellows. Now, okay, that was over, and then the Navy moved in
mm-hmm.
and made that their headquarters.
That didn't last very long.
That is the Navy commandant, you know, he had to leave Swinemünde.
Mm-hmm.
No, it wasn't the very last day.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing from them was, Mrs. Lewison, our ship is ready, I think in Albeck or in Swinemünde, to leave for your home country, Schleswig-Holstein,
mm-hmm.
please allow me to send you a man with a car who picks you up,
mm-hmm.
and we take you on a ship and take you back to Schleswig-Holstein.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, as she is, she said, oh, I'm just so sorry. My son called me from Stettin. He is wounded for the 7 times,
mm-hmm.
and he's coming back to here, and since he is coming, I cannot leave this place.
Mm-hmm.
So she stayed on. Then my brother arrived. He got a bicycle somewhere. One leg, you know, was bloody, he bound it up, and with the other leg, he
pedaled.
200 miles, he pedaled to the inland. And
mm-hmm.
there, they prepared for the Russians. So
they were there when the Russians came
yes.
in?
Yes.
How could you describe this briefly, what it was like when the Russians came in?
Behind this fence, we had already built pipe material in the ground. These were bunkers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had that
mm-hmm.
already built for the bombing
mm-hmm.
A year before, probably. And my brother had everything prepared here in this thing, food and so, that when the Russians came, they would move in. But my mother, as it is, she never went to bed. She had still go to the cattle or to the horses or to this or that. So she was in the kitchen working around when suddenly the Russians were there.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was in a bunker. But they didn't do much. They looked and said, and moved out to the next village. Very quickly,
mm-hmm.
they took whole loose. But then it became Russian headquarters.
The house.
The Russian commandant moved in here. You
mm-hmm.
see, all these ones. So down in that living room where von Braun was sitting with his group on it, there that fellow was sitting, and of course he was.
You know who it was?
Who it was?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't know what his name is. No, I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I just know the girls who served in the Ukraine girls. We just remembered the other day her name. Now, okay, they have to cook for him. And now happened one thing. They put one fellow in the village to prison, and his brother, his bricklayer, came and said to my brother, Reimer, you know the commandant very well, and said, why not talking to him to let him free? But he didn't know the commandant very well, but still he wanted to do him a favor and said, he's a nice fellow, could you not? And he was mad about that. He went up from the table, left the house. Next morning, from the mayor, town mayor, sent a fellow, my brother should get prepared to go for 3 days, take food. And he was only in a training suit because he was still wounded and going on crutches. And he always had every month malaria. So he left here. My mother looked from here, and this is the last time she saw him. Mm-hmm. Now we heard from him. He then was in a camp where also von Braun's father-in-law was. You know, his grandfather was a banker near Brandenburg in a camp. In that same camp my brother was. Mm-hmm. And in the next camp, which was only by a fence divided, there was the country teacher from this town. And he told us that one morning my brother had to line up in another group with their little baggage in front of them. All the young strong boys were out, and they were, as it says, we don't know, marched by foot to Petersburg. Mm. Now, we don't know what happened. Many things could happen. Mm. He was put malaria every month.
Did you ever see him again?
No.
You don't know?
No postcard, no
nothing. So you don't know whether...
You don't know. My mother hoped to the last day she would see him, but we haven't seen him.